From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama gives his State of the Union address tonight. America's soaring economic inequality is expected to be a major theme. Historically, Americans have seen mobility as the answer to inequality, the ability to rise up, to move up. A big new study says American mobility is at the back of the pack now and going nowhere, not worse, but not better as inequality rises. This hour On Point, inequality and mobility in America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you hear in the new numbers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll talk to a millionaire conservative who's pushing for a $12 an hour minimum wage in California. But first, joining me now in the studio is Nathan Hendren, professor of economics at Harvard University, co-author of the big new study published by the National Bureau of Economic Research titled, Is the United States Still a Land of Opportunity? Recent Trends in Intergenerational Mobility. Nathan Hendren, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the answer to the question? Is this a U.S. of A still a land of opportunity?
Well, I think the answer to the question is that over the last 20 to 25 years, the extent to which kids climb up and down the economic ladder hasn't changed a whole lot. But as you were saying earlier, the income inequality has increased, and so the difference between being at the top versus the bottom of the ladder has increased over time.
People have interpreted your study in many ways, saying the Wall Street Journal says it muddles the picture of all the mobility problems we're hearing about. Are you saying that America's never been a land of opportunity, or if it hasn't changed in all this time, what was it always?
Yeah.
Surely it was at some point, but where you go three decades back and even then, fairly low.
Well, I think the surprising thing to a lot of people is that our study is actually consistent with a range of studies that have found that the United States has lower rates of upward mobility relative to most other developed countries. So to give you some statistics, kids born in the bottom fifth of the income distribution in the United States have about a 1 in 12 chance of reaching the top fifth of the income distribution. And if you compare that to other countries in Western Europe, we actually rank near the bottom of countries like Finland, Canada, Norway, Sweden, Australia, Denmark, Germany, we're at the bottom in terms of mobility relative to those countries.
And not just by a little bit. Compare us to Denmark.
Right. So in Denmark, it's better than 1 in 7 kids born in the bottom fifth of their
income distribution. Almost twice as likely.
Almost twice as likely. That's exactly right. And I think that's comes as a surprise to a lot of Americans. And what our study shows is not only is there a big difference there, but it's also been pretty persistent for the last 25 or even longer years.
Not everybody needs to get to the top quintile, though increasingly these days there's so much wealth concentrated there. Maybe everybody wants to. What about going from the bottom to the middle class?
Yeah, so that's been relatively stable over time as well. The extent to which inequality has increased over the last 25 years, that's been primarily concentrated in the top rings of the income distribution. So when you look at the political rhetoric, a lot of that has noticed this rise in income accruing to the top 1%. And so when we talk about kind of how does that relate with mobility, that kind of is on front and center of people's minds, but also the extent to which kids are rising out of poverty into the middle class has remained stable as well.
And what about there compared to other developed nations? What are American chances compared to others in Europe, Canada, you name it?
Well, I think, it's hard to really get into the precise details of sort of different movements across the income distribution. But the general pattern is the extent of movement, anywhere along the income distribution is lower in the U.S. relative to other countries in Western Europe.
This is going to be at the heart of the President's State of the Union address tonight, this talk of inequality and opportunity, which kind of means mobility. In many ways, this is the heart of the American deal, the American dream. Start where you will, but have a good chance to get where you dream of going. What do your findings say about that assertion, that dream?
Well, I think that I don't want to say that's not in existence in the United States, but I think what a lot of people have in mind is that the United States is a place where a higher fraction of people rise out of the bottom regions of the income distribution.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter, that you're in that region today. Your kids are going to have a better chance of reaching other regions of the income distribution in the future. And what our findings suggest that you're going to rely on a lot more data than has been done in previous studies is that's actually really not true. Other countries have a higher rate at which kids come out of poverty than the United States does.
The United States mobility lower than that of the United Kingdom, which is supposed to have the big class society. Does it mean that the United States is a class society?
Well, that's a tough question for me to ask. You know, I think of all the countries in Europe, the United Kingdom is known for having lower rates of mobility relative to those other countries, and we're relatively similar.
Lower than that.
So I would say that the evidence there suggests we're very similar, and odds are we're slightly lower than the United Kingdom. That's
this right. is not welcome news. I mean, this is not the country we aspire to be. It's not the way we think of ourselves. What are the implications of this unmoving mobility when inequality has increased so much? Talk about the relationship between these two. What does it mean to have the stagnant mobility in a time of soaring inequality, the top getting higher and higher and higher?
Well, I think there's two ways to think about it. Going back to the ladder analogy, the rungs on the ladder are getting further apart, but the extent to which people are moving up and down it has remained stable. So that means on the one hand, kids are climbing farther than they have in the past to reach different portions of the income distribution.
We should be heartened by that, I guess.
And I think
anybody's making that giant leap.
Exactly. On the flip side, the difference in absolute outcomes to kids born to poor versus rich parents has increased because of the increase in inequality. So, take whichever side that you like. You can kind of spin it both ways.
How did you measure this? This sounds like a tough one to measure. You're talking about big numbers of mm-hmm. people, families. You've got to look at their background and then where they end up at some point in life. Describe your method.
Right. So we looked at the data from anonymous earnings records of more than 40 million kids spanning from kids born in 1971 to 1993. And we looked at numerous sets of outcomes. So we looked at earnings at age 26, at age 30. We also looked at college
tax returns.
This is data derived from anonymous and confidential data derived from tax returns. Okay. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And what we've did is look at the relationship between parental income and kid income and looked at different ages. You know, there's a lot of discussion that we can get into about what age do you need to measure kid income at, but we feel pretty comfortable being able to determine the patterns both across the United States and over time by looking at income at age 30.
You looked at 26 and 30, as
That's
I recall.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is that old enough to figure out where they're going to end up? I mean, in the last few years, there have been plenty of people who are barely getting their careers started at 30.
That's right. So this was actually surprising to us that we were able to do this. So the way to think about it is the way we measure people's kind of outcomes, the kids' outcomes, is where they fall in the distribution of kids' outcomes. So we're line everybody up and say, where do you fall relative to your peers? And what turns out is that your relative positioning in that ordering amongst your people that are also born in your same year starts to stabilize around age 30, whereas incomes are actually still fanning out. So, people at age 30 are still on different trajectories of incomes, but the relative position relative to their peers actually starts to become really relatively stable. So you can actually measure the relationship between parent and kid income at that age.
Of course, mobility is a two-way street. Real mobility means some will move up, some will move down.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the 1 in 12 chance of starting in the bottom 20% and getting to the top 20%. What about those who start in the top 20%? What are the odds of them floating down?
It's very similar. So I don't have the exact statistic in my mind, but if I remember, it's closer to 1 in 11, 1 in 10. But I think the thing to keep in mind with downward mobility, one thing we haven't talked about yet, mm-hmm. is that we did find a lot of variation across the United States in the extent to which kids are rising out of poverty. But we didn't find a whole lot of variation in the extent to which people are falling down the income ladder across the United States. So one way to interpret that is that there's a lot more kind of variation in the extent to which people are rising out of poverty relative to people who are falling down the income ladder.
So geographically, it varies. It kind of depends where you are, your chances of rising up. But over the whole country, if you're born in that top 20%, there's a very strong likelihood you're going to stay there.
Well, I think there is a greater than 30% chance you're going to stay in that.
I thought you said 1 in 10 or 11 that you would.
That you'd fall down to the bottom quintile.
To the bottom. Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah.
This is going all the way to the bottom.
Sorry, I was thinking of the reverse of the statistic that I was giving you earlier is about the same, yeah.
Yeah, to go all the way to the bottom. Of course, that's mm-hmm. quite a slide these
days. It is.
gosh, this is interesting. I don't know. How should this inform our policy thinking about what we do, throw off the reins or lay on more progressive policies? Democrats say we need more government programs. Republicans mm-hmm. say we need more wide open markets.
Well, I think that's a tough question. And I think, just to be frank, I don't think we have the answers to those mm-hmm. questions. I think what it does suggest is that it might put a different color on how you think about policies. A lot of policies we think aimed at income inequality, are very controversial. But yet policies aimed at mobility may be less controversial, kind of crosses the partisan divide, perhaps, when you think about giving kids an equal shot at rising to different portions of the income distribution rather than providing redistribution programs that are a little bit more polarizing.
So here we are for American kids born in that bottom 20%. And that's a lot of people. I mean, the message to them is you've got kind of an 8% chance of making it to the top. You've got a what sort of percent chance of making it up into the middle?
So, I mean, it depends how you define the middle. But, it, you know, it's a decent chance of making it into the middle. I think that, you know, it's about a 25% chance that you stay in the bottom regions and then about a 75% chance that you get out. So I think it's, you know, more than likely that you end up rising out. But I think the way to put that into comparison is to the best comparisons are to kind of say, how does that vary across areas and how does that vary to other countries? And I think the answer is we're much lower than other countries. You know, just to kind of put that statistic back before, that 8%, that 8% it varies a lot across areas. So in Salt Lake City, it's 12%. In San Francisco, it's 12%. In a place like Atlanta or Charlotte, it's 4 or 5%. So it's varying tremendously across areas, the extent to which these people are coming out rising up out of poverty.
The chance to make it from the bottom to the top, three times greater. I mean, 12% in Salt Lake City, San Francisco, Atlanta, Charlotte, down in 4 and 5% territory, that's really low. And for the country overall, to actually genuinely be able to claim that crown of land of opportunity, we would have to something like double our social mobility.
That's right, yeah. You know, I think the on the one hand, that sounds kind of crazy. On the flip side, there are pockets of the United States, like the Salt Lake Cities, the San Franciscos of the country, that have mobility rates that are not that far off from some of the best rates in Western Europe. So I don't want to say that it's not possible.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American inequality and American mobility, how we move and don't move up and down the economic ladder now. A big news study is just out. One of its co-authors, Nathan Hendren of Harvard, joins me in the studio today. The president expected to talk a fair bit about inequality and opportunity, mobility, in his State of the Union address tonight. Here he was last month in Washington, the speech talking about income inequality at a community center in Anacostia, one of the poorest sections of Washington, D.C.
A dangerous and growing inequality and lack of upward mobility that has jeopardized middle-class America's basic bargain, that if you work hard, you have a chance to get ahead. I believe this is the defining challenge of our time, making sure our economy works for every working American.
We're going to hear a lot about it, making sure that everybody is still in the deal, the kind of American dream. Nathan Hendren is with me in the studio. Lots of calls for you. David in Hartsville, Tennessee. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. I see that Denmark and these other European countries are moving ahead of us with a more progressive type of federal government, and I think it is the right thing to do to push forward with opportunity. I see it not possible to save much money and really move forward without making it north of $40,000 a year for a family, and we're just not paying people correctly.
So look to Europe for some of their policy formula, maybe. David, I appreciate your call. Nathan Hendren, I know you're giving us a solution is not your job here, but you have compared U.S. mobility with that in Europe. Now, Europe famously does tend to have more progressive social welfare policies and, I think, a narrower range when it comes to overall earnings and equality. But you tell us.
Well, you know, I think that's, as you say, I think that's a tough question for us to really get at. We don't have a good sense of what the driving factors are for generating more mobility in the United States.
But don't we have an object? Listen, I mean, look at it anywhere you want. There's Europe. And we're always throwing stones from this country at, they don't do this and they don't do that. And it's too much social welfare. But their mobility is higher than ours.
Well, sure. You know, I think if you want to, you don't have to look to Europe to answer that question. I think you can look within the United States and you can look at places that have very high rates of mobility. And we have looked at what the characteristics are of those places. And we came up with five. So these are places that have less racial and economic segregation. They have
You're talking
less
Salt Lake, San Francisco, where else?
San Francisco. So a bit broadly, you want to think of the West, you want to think of the Midwest, and you want to think of the Northeast. If you want to look at areas that have lower rates of upward mobility, you want to think of the South and the Rust Belt. And I think think if you you look across what are the characteristics of places that have upward mobility, it's places that have less residential and economic segregation.
Mm-hmm.
It's places that have less middle-class income inequality. It's places that have higher higher quality schools. It's places that have greater degrees of score higher on measures of social capital and civic engagement. And it's areas that have stronger family structures. So places that have a higher fraction of two-parent households, those tend to have higher rates of upward mobility. And you know, so what we can do is we can paint the picture of what mobile places look like.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we can give you a good path of what is the precise and best way to get to the, get there. But I think that's a really important question.
What was the second one there? Middle class?
Middle class income inequality. So we try to be a little bit specific about how to think about income inequality. And you know, there's been a long, a big rise over the last 25 years in the fraction of income that has accrued to the top 1%. And there's also been a moderate increase in income inequality, kind of middle class income inequality, for the difference between, say, the people of the 75th versus 25th percentile. And when you look across the United States, what seems to be a stronger correlate of with mobility is the middle class income inequality, the difference between being at the kind of the lower end of the upper class and the upper end of the lower class. And you don't see a strong correlation between the fraction of income accruing to the top 1% and upward mobility.
Now, your study finds that income economic mobility has not gotten worse in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard from many people, Democrats and Republicans. I mean, Paul Ryan out there saying that it's gotten worse. Where did that idea come from, that mobility's gotten worse?
Yeah, so
not that it was good to begin with by your numbers, and Europe way ahead of us, Canada too now, but where'd that come from?
Yeah, so there's a wide range of studies that have been done over the past 15 years, and they have kind of a mixed set of results. Some suggesting no real change in mobility, and some suggesting a decline in mobility. Generally, the ones that have suggested a decline in mobility have suffered some data limitations where they weren't able to really measure both parent and kid income at the for this within a family, and so they've gone through various routes of trying to kind of overcome those limitations. And where we come in is to bring in this data set that has more than 40 million kids and their parents to try to really get at this question in the right way.
Let's go to our listeners, Ron in Buffalo, New York. Ron, you're on the air with Nathan Hendren.
Hi, thank you. I was calling to talk about the income inequality and mobility issue, obviously. I see the problem as being sort of threefold. The first issue is that there does not seem to be any real political motivation to support or strengthen the public school system in this country. Rather, there seems to be a move towards privatization of schools and charter schools, which my fear is that if you're coming from a family that is economically solvent, the chances of your children getting a reasonable education is much greater than, you know, if you're having to send your children to private or public school. And there seems to be no motivation to improve the public school system. Rather, the trend seems to be to defund and dismantle the public school system. This is at the same time that there's a dismantling of working class blue-collar jobs and attacks on the unions across the country. So what it boils down to is that it's hard to climb the ladder if there's no ladder there anymore.
You know, Ron, I hear exactly what you're saying, but of course, many champions of charter schools have said they've come in to do it because public schools weren't serving poor communities in this country, Ron.
Well, and I agree that the public schools are not adequately serving the poor. And that's the problem that needs to be addressed, is doing.
Ron, I appreciate your call. Nathan Hendren in Buffalo. Thanks, Ron. You talk about the birth lottery, and this mm-hmm. is part of what Ron's going to here. If your family has money, if you're up the ladder, you can afford to lay on the education and other things that are more likely to keep you up there. What about the significance of that and how that matters in a time of great inequality? It's not an easy pole vault up there.
Right. You know, I think that's a good point. And I think there is evidence, you know, we were talking about what's the evidence of declining mobility over time. There's some great evidence from Bob Putnam and co-authors looking at the expenses that affluent families have been making on their kids over time. And there's a lot of evidence suggesting that there's more resources being put into kids recently relative to 20 years ago. Now, the perhaps interesting thing is that that doesn't seem to be correlated into greater kind of persistence at the top. It seems to be relatively stable. So we don't know, are those investments being kind of fruitless? Or the counteracting other forces like rising income inequality that would otherwise make the country more mobile.
Bill Gates was talking. We heard last week Oxfam came out with these numbers. 87 individuals in the world have as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion people. And out of that, some people were saying, well, that means the poor are in trouble all over the place. And he was saying, no, this is interesting that around the world, this was Bill Gates talking on the Morning Joe last week, saying, no, in fact, in most of the world, there are dramatic rises in the status of the poor. Here's Bill Gates.
Income inequality is an important issue, but the poor are not getting poorer. That's just absolutely, completely, and totally wrong. If you take a country like China, which had a third of the world's poor people, they reduced their poverty rate from 60% down to 10%. And their economic growth has been much, much faster than the rich countries. And so as you get these middle-income countries, the poor in the world, actually, this has been a great 25 years for them.
If you're poor in China, going from 60% in poverty to 10%, that sounds great. Now, of course, it's easier when you're maybe at the beginning of this, but that says this ought to be done. He says they've had great economic growth. The problem is in this country, the economic growth has not necessarily been shared, especially in the last half dozen years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just to keep the things in perspective, the United States is a richer country today than it was 25 years ago. And I think it's true that
and you're talking relative mobility here within that.
Within that, the extent to which people are moving up and down in that ladder has remained stable. And so I think, you know, we're talking about the difference between outcomes for rich versus poor. And that has increased in kind of absolute terms, but just the levels of outcomes for the poor has increased over time. So, you know, just to keep this in perspective, it's not like we're in this tremendously dire straits here. It's just the extent to which people are moving up and down, and that income distribution is what remains stable.
Though when it comes to issues of social cohesion, the sense we're all in it together, the sense that we really have an opportunity in this country to go for it, there's where the question marks are dancing right now. Albert in Palm Beach, Florida. Albert, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
You're taking the call. My point here is that whether it's a mobility, inequality, income gap, poverty, whatever, they're all terms that are intimately related to each other and at the bottom line, the same, one and the same. And two things must happen in order to address those issues and to make any headway. One is a good education, and the other one is a good job. A good job without an educated person is useless. And good education without a good job waiting there is useless.
Albert, let me ask you about another factor that's getting a lot of attention, and I think the president may talk about it tonight, is the family structure and support. What about that piece?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct. The family is very, very important. I come from a family who my parents were well-educated. They were not wealthy by any means. But the education and the presence of father and mother are very important elements.
Of course.
Without any question.
That is something that is absent in very wide swaths of the American population now. What about in your five factors that may indicate success? You know how this two-parent family support, this is getting a lot of support. Republicans have always been there. Now some Democrats are talking about this too. What do you find?
Well, I think, you know, it's a nuanced picture. So it is absolutely true. One of the strongest correlations we were able to find in the data is that areas that have a higher fraction of two-parent households have higher rates of upward mobility. Now, what's particularly nuanced there is that we find higher rates of upward mobility for kids both born to married parents and to single parents. And so it's not just
if they're in that community.
If they're in that community. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be really something that's operating at the level of the community. There's something about places where there are more two-parent households that also makes them have higher rates of upward mobility. So I think it's more a nuanced picture than just it matters to be in a two-parent household. It's more something about what's going on at the place and the environment of the area.
Of course, you hear the argument that where the economy is tougher, families are more likely to break up. You got a lot of people in prison, a lot of people who can't find jobs. These are tough circumstances in which to have that stable two-parent family, that kind of community. Robbie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Robbie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. It's nice to talk about changing social circumstances, and it's important, but the important thing to do is to break the cycle. Breaking the cycle takes resources, and resources need to come from people who have them. It's not the 1%, it's the 0.1%. I would refer your listeners to Paul Krugman's article yesterday. These people have amassed an enormous amount of money, and have used their money to lobby for special tax status. The carried interest exception protects their income, keeps their tax rates lower than their secretaries. They have intergenerational preferences. Unless we make a societal push to ask them to contribute to the society that provided the necessary, if not sufficient, conditions for them to amass so much wealth, where are the resources going to come from to attack the societal problems, the societal supports that your panelist is talking about that need to be done?
Robbie, thanks for raising it just that way. Nathan, what do you say to Robbie's tough observation?
Well, you know, I think where we get the money, I think, is a matter of political debate, and what we do about it is a matter of political debate. I think that there's reasonable positions at this point on all sides because we don't have a really good picture of what exactly are the best policies to improve mobility in the U.S. and really bring it on par with the rest of Western Europe.
But we know the inequality. We know how it's soared. That means resources, wealth is flowing to mm-hmm. the top. Robbie talks about tax policies. Of course, they've mm-hmm. changed some in the Obama years. But overall, we're not pulling that back down in a very active way, redistribution-wise. Mm-hmm. Do you guys come up with any position on whether or not that matters, whether or not that's the way? Or do you have a Republican angle on this that, hey, throw the reins off, open the markets, and then we'll dance?
Well, you know, I guess maybe we're going to be a little frustrating. We're going to try to stay agnostic on that and just mm-hmm. try to be as centered as we can and provide the statistics on what mobility is in the United States and give people a picture of what that looks like. Now, where people want to go with that, I think that's open for the political debate.
What mobility is and what it isn't. Moya in Charleston, South Carolina. Moya, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
Well, I had a couple of things. One of the things is I don't know what class I belong, but I know that I have, as a single mom and as a nurse, an RN, it is very difficult at times to, you know, make ends meet. And it's particularly difficult when you've, you know, done all kinds of crazy things to get a daughter educated in South Carolina. You know, I did the charter school thing, and I actually moved at one point. And then the college comes up. And then my daughter's saying to me, there's no point going to college. I'll still end up working where I'm working right now with the same wage, even with a college degree. So should we spend all this money on college or not? So my daughter, I have a terrible fear she's not going to, you know, get there because the college tuition is so high for people in my income bracket.
Moya, you may be our best social scientist of the hour, and I'm really glad for your call, and I wish luck to your daughter. I mean, Nathan, thank you, Moya. This is where this really matters. People are watching. Young people are watching. If you don't buy the American dream, you know, get educated and go for it, and you'll get it. If you don't buy that, Moya's daughter saying, why should I go to college? Why should I do this? I mean, how do you keep the whole great engine going if people look at these numbers, compare us to other countries, and say, you know what? The dream isn't real.
Wow. You know, I think that's not at all the interpretation I think anybody should take away from what we find. I think we find lower rates of
upward mobility. You're saying our mobility is half that of Denmark.
That's right.
It's the back of the pack in the developed world. It doesn't mean you can't do it, but it doesn't line up with our mythology.
I think giving up, certainly for kids out there who are looking to decide whether or not to go to college, looking at our statistics and making a decision about whether to go to college is the wrong thing to do. I think you want to think about all the evidence out there that suggests there's a high return to college and make that decision in the best way possible.
Moya, have your daughter listen to that. Have her not give up. Have us not as a nation give up on trying to live up to our sense of the land of opportunity just as fully as we can. Why do you think this is so much more a more keenly felt issue now than it was 30, 40 years ago if mobility hasn't changed, Nathan?
Well, I think that, you know, I think we all have this perception in the United States that there's an opportunity out there for our children, and we want to make that opportunity as large as possible. And I think we now have some evidence that suggests we're not living up to the kind of stereotypes that we have in our mind for who we are.
That matters when it comes to motivation, when it comes to social cohesion. Nathan Hendren and a great gang of scholars have put together this new report for the National Bureau of Economic Research. The title is the United States Still a Land of Opportunity? Recent Trends in Intergenerational Mobility. He's with us in the studio today over from Harvard. Nathan Hendren, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Obama will announce tonight that he is ordering the minimum wage for federal contractors to be raised from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. There's a push on in Congress to raise the minimum wage for all Americans to $10.10 an hour. A millionaire conservative in California, Ron Unz, is pushing a state ballot measure for a $12 minimum wage in California. Unz says it's time to stop allowing big companies to pay so little that the government has to step in with services to support the working poor. In a moment, we'll hear from an economist who disagrees. Ron Unz joins me now from Stanford, California. He's chairman of the Higher Wages Alliance. Ron Unz, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Great to be here.
We've heard you make the case, but make it for us right now. Why a $12 minimum wage for California?
Well, the situation right now is that so many tens of millions of low-wage workers in the United States can't get by on their own paychecks. Therefore, they receive vast numbers of dollars from the taxpayer and the government. The total around the country is $250 billion a year in social welfare spending going to the working poor. If the working poor were paid a reasonable wage by their employer, they would no longer be eligible for many of those programs, and the taxpayers would save tens of billions of dollars a year. What we have right now is a system where many of these businesses have privatized the benefits of their workers, they get the work, and socialized the costs, shifted the expense to the rest of society and the taxpayer. And I don't think that makes any sense.
How are your fellow conservatives responding to your call for a $12 an hour minimum wage in California?
Surprisingly open to the idea. I mean, the minimum wage is an issue that really dropped off the American radar screen 10, 20, 30 years ago. It hasn't been one of these hot-button ideological issues. The main concern conservatives have is whether a higher minimum wage would cause massive job loss. The evidence is that it wouldn't. Very few workers would lose their jobs. They're in the non-tradable service sector. All that would happen would be that the extra costs would be passed along to the consumer, and the price rises would be very small. Walmart could cover a $12 an hour minimum wage by raising their prices 1% one time.
1% one time at Walmart and just keep it there on out, and that would cover all this. If you had a $12 an hour minimum wage in California, what would that mean if you had a two-income family? Where would that put their annual earnings?
It would be a life-changing difference. A single worker at $12 an hour minimum wage would make $25,000 a year. A couple would make $50,000 a year. $50,000 a year doesn't make you affluent, it doesn't make you rich, but you can generally get by on something like that. And the taxpayers would save tens of billions of dollars each year nationwide if something like that were generally adopted.
There's the argument from millionaire Ron Unz. He's former publisher of the American Conservative. He's saying higher minimum wage in California, $12 an hour. David in Oklahoma City is calling. David, you're on the air with Ron Unz. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Well, I certainly agree with a higher minimum wage, but I think the minimum wage should be tied to the skill set required of the job. In other words, here in Oklahoma, if you worked at a convenience store, you might make $10.50 an hour. As a cashier, interfacing with the public, but if somebody was working in the local high-tech electronics plant, they might be looking at, we would hope, $12, $15 an hour as a starting wage, because the skill set required would be tied to, you know, higher education, that type of thing, more cost to start that position. Whereas right now, as an example, if you work at the local computer technology service center for $8 an hour or whatever, that individual is not necessarily motivated to take some of that income and improve their education.
So tie it to skills, David. And we've got that out of Oklahoma City. Ron Unz in California, what do you say?
Well, I certainly agree that different workers based on their skills and their experience should be paid differently. I'm just talking about raising up the bottom to the point where people who have full-time jobs can survive on their own wages rather than force the taxpayer to bail them out and bail out their business. Also, another thing to bear in mind is that California is in a very expensive state. Costs here are 30% above the national average. So $12 an hour minimum wage in California is really more like $9 or $9.50 on the national level and is not at all an aggressive figure.
Ron Unz, a millionaire, conservative, former publisher of the American Conservative out of California, saying $12 an hour is what they need for a minimum wage in California. Ron Unz, stand by there in Stanford. With us now from Fairfax, Virginia, is Tyler Cowen, chairman, general director of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, professor of economics, author of Average is Over. Tyler Cowen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What do you make of Ron's argument? Time for a $12 an hour minimum wage on the books in California.
I disagree completely. The very best economic research suggests this will put many people out of work. At the national level, a minimum wage of $12 an hour would quite literally put millions out of work. A higher minimum wage is a bad way of helping poor people. It would cover the people it covers, only about 11% of them are in poor households. A better way to help poor people is to give them cash or boost the earned income tax credit.
Ron Unz, A, it would put millions out of work, and B, there are better ways, earned income tax credit and more. We've been hearing from Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio. First of all, you'll put a lot of people out of work. What do you say, Ron?
Oh, that's nonsense. Again, we're talking about the non-tradable service sector, jobs that aren't in foreign competition, jobs that can't be outsourced.
They're not all non-tradable. We've still got, you know, we make T-shirts in this country and other things that could still be shipped abroad or back abroad?
Very few of the low-wage workers we're talking about are in manufacturing or tradable sets. It really is basically the non-tradable service sector. And again, the price rises involved are negligible. 1% at Walmart, agricultural products, American-grown agricultural products, would only be 2% more at the grocery shelves if the 12-hour minimum wage were implemented. Regarding the earned income tax credit and some of the other proposals that Professor Cowen has brought up, I disagree strongly. Those, again, are welfare programs.
Describe
those
how that would work, what's being proposed there, Ron?
Well, it's basically that the earned income tax credit and these other programs are that if you are too poor, the government sends you money. The government sends you a check. It's welfare. It's welfare funded by the taxpayer. I think businesses should be forced to pay their own workers rather than be able to shift the costs to the general taxpayer, and that really is a very free market type of argument.
Tyler Cowen, respond to that assertion that Ron Unz makes, that Walmart and many others who pay rather low wages are essentially freeloading on the American taxpayer who ends up subsidizing those workers with all kinds of social programs.
There's an even bigger subsidy if we put those people out of work. Right now, we have a weak labor market. The alternative doesn't have to be outsourcing. It can simply be employers who wait. We're seeing more automation than ever before. And here's a way to think about the difference between an earned income tax credit and minimum wage. Minimum wage, you're trying to get workers more money, but you're making it more costly for businesses to hire them. That's exactly what you don't want to do if you want to boost private employment.
What do you say, Ron? I mean, this is a big gamble if indeed it would put a bunch of people out of work.
But the studies show that very few people would lose their jobs. Here's an example. 17 years ago, in 1996, California put a 35% increase in the minimum wage on the ballot. It passed overwhelmingly. The critics said it would cause massive unemployment. Instead, unemployment dropped by one-third in the 4 years that followed. San Jose put a 25% hike in the minimum wage on the ballot a year ago. Again, critics said it would cause massive unemployment. Unemployment dropped by 2 percentage points in the 12 months since then. There's no evidence a large minimum wage hike would cause high unemployment. Also, we're talking about raising the wages with a $12 figure of 40% of all the wage earners in California. It would shift $15 billion a year into the sort of households that spend every dollar they earn, which would boost the economy. I think it would be the best thing that ever happened to Walmart and many of our other businesses that are struggling because consumers don't have the money to shop anymore.
Tyler Cowen, I want to ask you who in the conservative community might be coming around to this idea and who may not be. Now, $12 an hour in California is one thing, a special part of the country maybe. $10.10 is the push in Congress right now. And interestingly, Earlier this month, we heard on Fox News Bill O'Reilly saying that he was fine with that. 6% of American workers, he said, earning the minimum wage. President's proposed $10.10, and here's Bill O'Reilly saying, okay, let's go.
I think Americans in general would be willing to pay a few more cents for products to up it to 10 bucks. Again, it's only 6%.
Tyler Cowen, how's the conservative world break down here? Who's for a higher minimum wage and who's not?
Well, let's look at the own words of Ron Unz. Ron actually admits that a higher minimum wage will destroy a lot of jobs. He just stresses that it's the jobs of immigrants. And his real goal, as I read his own words, is actually to limit low-skilled immigration into the U.S. and also into Canada. In a recent debate, here's what Ron said. He said, not only am I not a trained economist, I've never even taken a class in economics. I've never even opened an economics textbook. I personally don't claim to really understand most economics. That's what he said. So what he's doing is coming to California with what is essentially a cultural plan to keep out low-skilled immigrants and cloaking it with the rhetoric of a populist economic idea. But the economic research is on the side of saying this will boost unemployment. And again, there are simply better ways of helping the poor. The fact that some conservatives are leaping on this bandwagon is just showing there are a lot of people worried about immigration. But let's debate that issue on its own terms.
Ron Unz, I am looking at you quoted here saying you look at a job that pays $7.25 an hour, you raise the value of that job to $12 an hour, and suddenly a lot of Americans would take those jobs. Is this a kind of a immigration reform by other means here, Ron?
Oh, that's certainly an aspect of it. What we're talking about right now is we have 11 or 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States. They come here for jobs. The reason the jobs are available is that Americans won't take the jobs, just as business lobbyists always claim. But the reason Americans won't take the jobs is the wages are too low to survive. If the wages were $12 an hour, many American citizens, legal immigrants, and in fact illegal immigrants who've been here for many years would take those jobs. And we wouldn't have the situation where we're drawing in desperate people to come here or taking jobs nobody else will. Regarding my economics background, I'm the first person to admit I don't have an economics background. I'm a theoretical physicist by training. But when you look at what's happened to the American economy in the last 10 or 20 years, run by people who allegedly know economics, it hasn't really done very well. Furthermore, just last week, 7 economics Nobel laureates endorsed a much higher minimum wage, and they obviously do know economics.
Tyler says that your core motivation here is to stop immigrants or turn them around. All right. How do you see Professor Cowen's motivation?
Well, I mean, look, again, the illegal immigration issue is one of many benefits for something like this. It would certainly boost the economy, and certainly the vast majority of illegal immigrants who have been here for years would get the wage hike we're talking about along with everybody else. But Professor Cowen is one of these strong libertarians who disagrees with the notion of a minimum wage. He and the people around him, in fact, that person who was in the debate, one of his close colleagues, Brian Kaplan, who debated me, that Cowen just quoted, in the debate, Kaplan said, America should allow unlimited people from overseas to come here and work for a dollar a day, so long as they agree to receive no medical care or any other social services. Now, I think a situation where tens of millions of American workers are living in hovels and die in the street if they break their leg is a terrible idea. But that, again, is the belief of extreme libertarians who believe in abolishing the minimum wage. I don't believe in that.
Tyler Cowen, is that what you're for? No minimum wage, sir?
Ron Unz is attacking my colleague rather than myself. I do not think open borders is a workable solution. I think you can make some argument that a small boost in the minimum wage would not harm employment, but a large boost to $12 an hour is not what any Nobel laureate has endorsed. We cannot repeal the laws of supply and demand, and what we need to do now is lower the cost of hiring people, not raise it.
Let's go to Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Here's the huge elephant in the room here. It's all about productivity. Now, if the minimum wage were indexed to productivity gains over the last several decades, it would be $17 an hour now. Now, how do we do that? We do that like we did before, from the end of World War II to the early 80s, when wages tracked in line with productivity gains all the way till Reagan. And why did that happen? Because unions were 30% of the workforce, so they had a voice. And since the attack on unions, they've had no voice. So that line, that wage line, has stayed flat while productivity gains have just soared. And when you compare that to Northern Europe, what's the difference? Why are they ahead of us? Because their union voice, the workers have a voice to claim their fair share of those productivity gains.
Tom, we've got it loud and clear there. Nail it to productivity. You said go to $17 an hour. Now we're really getting up there. Ron Unz, you are putting up a ballot initiative in California. How's that going? And if you get enough signatures to put it on the ballot, what do you think of the odds this will pass?
I think it's really going quite well. There's a tremendous amount of support for it. I think it will get on the ballot, and I think it may pass overwhelmingly. Furthermore, it helps to focus national attention on this issue. And I think it's a very good sign that the Democrats, after having backed off from minimum wage increases for a number of years, are now getting back on that issue. I also agree that the notion that the minimum wage should be stagnant, it's right now 30% lower in real terms than it was 45 years ago, which is ridiculous, while American productivity, the productivity of American workers, has doubled. The minimum wage should be much, much higher than it is today, and that would allow workers to share the fruits of the gains in our society rather than all of it going to the 1%.
Tyler Cowen, do you see Republicans in Congress going even for the $10.10 that's going to be on the table there?
I will predict it's not going to happen.
Because they agree with you, you're saying, most Republicans, that it would mean fewer jobs.
Because they agree with me, they understand the core point that, yes, we do need to help poor people, but we need to do this by making it easier to hire them, not more difficult and more costly. There are many ways of helping the poor. There's not a good reason why this should be our main campaign.
Tyler Cowen, author of Average is Over, joining us from George Mason University. Thank you very much, Tyler Cowen.
Thank you.
Ron Unz, are you being run out of town by fellow conservatives? Tyler certainly isn't buying your $12 an hour.
Well, again, there's a lot of division of opinion, but when I've talked with individual conservatives, they're very open to the idea, so long as they see that the job loss issue is not nearly as severe as it's been made out to be.
Ron Unz, chairman of the Higher Wages Alliance in Stanford, California. Thanks for joining us, Ron. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.